The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to Too Jewish with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Josh Flagg, star of Bravo TV's reality show Million Dollar Listing, and author of a new book, A Simple Girl, Stories My Grandmother Told Me. We'll also have a visit from our Mevina on Jewish Ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach. It's Purim today, the much-anticipated silly holiday of early spring celebration. It's also rodeo weekend here in southern Arizona, a throwback to the days when Tucson really was a cow town and not a city of a million people. So it's kind of a fun debate for me. Here on Too Jewish, do I go with the Purim theme or the rodeo theme? Well, since our show is Too Jewish and not Too Western, I choose Purim. I might even have to cast lots to choose. To play us in, here's a very silly Purim song from the Sephardic Jews of Tangier in North Africa about hosts who serve water instead of wine on the free-flowing holiday of Purim, Kichlot Yeni.
Kichlot Yeni, tereni, Kichlot Yeni, tereni, Kichlot Yeni, tereni,
That was Kichlot Yeni, Joy of Wine, from the CD, The Sword of the Dove, by the wonderful Sephardic group Voice of the Turtle. Before we run off to the races this morning, I have to start with a serious note. Purim remembers the dramatic events 2,500 years ago or so when enemies sought to destroy our people, the Jews. That desire has not disappeared from the world. In fact, you can make the case that Purim celebrates nothing more than basic Jewish survival against long odds, with gambling a theme that recurs throughout the Purim story and in its customs. In a way, being Jewish throughout history has always been a bit of a gamble, and we have survived on our own wits and through many miraculous redemptions, as well as by climbing out of the ashes of one Jewish civilization after another from generation to generation. Purim celebrates the victory of the Jews of the Persian Empire, you know, Iran, over a great enemy, Haman, in the reign of the Persian king Artaxerxes, the Hebrew Ahasuerus, about 2,500 years ago. You know, Haman reminds me of another guy, Ahmadinejad, the current president of Persia, Iran. Anyway, we make quite a fuss on Purim over the beautiful Jewish Queen Esther, who persuaded the king to save the Jews, and we cheer wildly for Mordechai, her uncle or cousin, the wise advisor who convinced Esther to step forward when only she could save us all. Purim is great fun, but at its heart, it is also a kind of desperate story of near destruction and bare survival. And that was in Persia, where in general Jews lived very well then and were not persecuted much. The message of Purim is clear. We Jews are always an endangered minority. We need at least a couple of individuals, even court Jews, who have the direct ear of the person in power. Without that, we can be destroyed. Perhaps this is no longer true here in America, but history reminds us that it's never wrong to be vigilant, that even in our joy we should remember the very serious consequences of failing to do so. So nu, it's Purim. Back to happier stuff. It is a Two Jewish tradition on Rodeo Weekend when we Southern Arizonans here in Tucson, where I live, celebrate our Western heritage to play a classic Jewish Western song, a legendary number called The Ballad of Irving. It's in honor of all those Jewish cowboys and characters, a less than perfectly accurate musical version of one of those legendary Jews of the Old West. Long before saddles blazed across the West, there was Irving.
He was short and fat and rode out of the West with a Mogan David on his silver vest. He was mean and nasty right clear through, which was kind of weird because he was yellow too. They called him Irving. Big Irving. Big short Irving. Big short fat Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. He came from the old bar mitzvah spread, schlepping a salami and pumpernickel bread. He always followed his mother's wishes. Even on the range, he used two sets of dishes. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sissy Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Well, finally, Irving got three slugs in the belly. It was right outside the Frontier Deli. He was sitting there twirling his gun around, and Butterfingers Irving gunned himself down. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big dum-dum Irving. Big dum-dum dead Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Really?
The Ballad of Irving, about being Jewish in the Wild West. You know, sort of. Nowadays, of course, we Southwestern Jews are much more sophisticated and we hope braver than Irving. There is another great and slightly Jewish event this week, the beginning of spring training, the best way to see a ball game of all. The Cactus League here in Arizona throws out its first pitch this coming week to celebrate the spring and give us a Jewish leg up on spring training ball for 2010. Here's Mandy Patinkin's Yiddish version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Spieler, es passt nicht, als man verspielt, weil sie sehen, zwei, drei Spikes, neues bei der Baseballspiel.
That was Mandy Patinkin singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game in Yiddish for the coming of baseball spring training, my personal favorite season of the year. Boy, do we have fun today on Too Jewish on Purim, huh? Well, when we come back in a few minutes, don't answer that, by the way. When we come back in a few minutes, we'll meet our guest, Josh Flagg, the very young star of the TV show Million Dollar Listing, author of a new book on his grandmother's remarkable story. You won't want to miss it. When we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Passover is coming up fast, so why is this night different from all other nights? Because you can spend it with Rabbi Sam Kohan, enjoying a Seder in a way that makes Passover live and breathe as never before for every age. And this year, it's part of the 100th anniversary of Temple Emmanuel, which makes this an even more extraordinary night. To truly experience this great festival of freedom, join Rabbi Sam Kohan for a second night Passover Seder that's simply the finest in Southern Arizona. This celebration is on Tuesday night, March 30th at 6 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel. Reservations are a must. Call 520-327-4501. The food is great and kosher, but it's the stories, songs, and spirit of Rabbi Kohan that'll make this a Seder you'll never forget. Learn, enjoy, laugh, cry, and eat well. Call 327-4501 to make your reservation now for Tuesday, March 30th, a memorable second night of Passover with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Or if you live on the northwest side of Tucson, there will also be a second night Seder in the northwest with Rabbi Ben Sharp. Call 327-4501 for more information on how to make this the best Passover ever through Temple Emmanuel.
To welcome our guest, Josh Flagg, star of the TV show Million Dollar Listing, we have an appropriate cut from a Jewish singer, Stephen Page of the Bare Naked Ladies.
If I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a house, I would buy you.
We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish this morning, Josh Flagg. Josh is an extraordinary young man. As his own bio says, he likes setting records. He's one of the stars of Bravo TV's Million Dollar Listing, which is, I think, in its second season. He's one of the top young realtors probably in the country, has participated in a series of the highest sales in Southern California, which is not a low-ticket market, and this in a very difficult time economically. He's also written a very interesting book called A Simple Girl about his grandmother's survival during the Nazi regime during World War II and her successes here in the United States. Welcome to Too Jewish, Josh Flagg. Good morning.
Good morning.
Josh, tell us a little bit about how you got involved with Bravo TV, just for those of us who don't know.
Well, you know, I do what I do in California real estate-wise, and I'm going to do a show about young real estate professionals. The show was already around, but it was a little bit different of a format, so they wanted to change it around and have three young real estate professionals, and they came up with this concept, and it worked.
It's actually a lot of fun. I would never have thought that would be an enjoyable thing to watch, but it's, do you watch it yourself?
No, I don't watch it. I watch it, yes, but not on TV.
In real life.
Yes, I watch it before it comes out.
You know, you're involved with a variety of charities. We'll talk about some of those later, but, tell us a little bit about Edith Flagg, your grandmother.
My grandmother is a Holocaust survivor. She came to the United States with no money in her pocket. She built a huge business from nothing, just her own two hands and she was in the right place at the right time, and it worked out. She was in the clothing business, and she was the first person to bring polyester to the United States in 1967, which was very lucrative for her. And
so can we blame her for all those leisure suits in the 1970s?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
She designed most of those. And then, of course, people started to copy her. But for the first couple of years, that was her, you know, she
that was her thing.
Doing it.
Wow. You decided to write a book about her. Tell us, you know, what it was like. I mean, it's very different from selling real estate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, and we travel around the world together. So we'd take trips, and I would record her, and I would go around, and I would write her stories down. We'd somehow, it took 10 years, but finally it came together, and now her book is done.
How does she feel about it?
She loves it. It's a great book. I mean, it's an incredible story. You know, she's pretty well known around town, so everyone knows her story, and they've always told her for years, you got to write your book, you got to write a story. She's like, I'm not interested, but I finally did it, and it's gotten really, it's an incredible story. I mean, she's a single woman during the war with a baby, posing as a Red Cross nurse. You know, her first husband died in a concentration camp. This woman, you know, carried a gun with her. She was a member of the Dutch underground, so, you know, that takes a lot to do something like that.
We will talk much more with Josh Flagg. He is Bravo TV's Million Dollar Listing and author of the book A Simple Girl about his grandmother, Edith Flagg, who we just learned brought polyester to the United States in the 1960s. We'll talk much more with Josh a little later this morning here on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmaker's Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter, Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grand, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
Looking for a unique dining experience with menu selections made from scratch from the freshest ingredients? The Beeline, located at 621 North 4th Avenue, sets a new precedent with high-quality food and beverages in a counter-service setting. This blend has earned the Beeline the Best Casual Dining Award from Tucson Weekly 5 times. From their perfectly spiced mahi fish tacos to their popular pasta dishes featuring vodka, pesto, or traditional Italian red sauce, you are sure to find something perfect for your taste. Try their scrumptious dessert selection, carefully prepared from scratch by their talented pastry chef. Enjoy wines by the glass or bottle, microbrew, craft beers are on tap. The Beeline, 621 North 4th Avenue. Stop by or call 882-7575. Visit their retail location, Time Market on University Boulevard near 4th Ave, with a great selection of over 300 different wines and 100 beers and gourmet foods to go. Call 882-7575 for the Beeline and Time Market. Unique casual dining experiences. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us, please, at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts.
To life, l'chaim. L'chaim, l'chaim, to life. Here's to the father I've tried to be.
Here's to my bride-to-be.
Bring l'chaim to life, l'chaim.
You know, I was reflecting on our interview on Too Jewish last week with Theodore Bickel, the outstanding actor and singer who has performed the role of Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof over 2,000 times. When we chatted, I asked Bickel how he managed to keep himself fresh, playing a part and saying the same lines he has said so many times. I mean, if he was just starting to play Tevye today, and if he played the role every single day of the year, it would take him something like 6 years without vacations just to reach the number of performances he's had in that marvelous part. So how does he keep it from becoming routine, a dull performance? Bickel answered that every show is a new experience, each stage different, every audience unique. It's never the same show, he said, so how could he get bored? To be honest, I felt a little silly for having asked. After all, nobody ever asks me Rabbi, cantor, haven't you chanted the Hashkivinu prayer enough times now? How do you keep it interesting? Although they could ask, I suppose. Jewish prayer in general includes a great deal of repetition. It's especially true of the Orthodox and even conservative liturgies, but it's also true for Reform Judaism. After all, each Shabbat, every Sabbath, we sing and read virtually the same prayers. Our task is to continually make these standardized texts into something personally important and fresh. In this, we are actually attempting to imitate God, who manages Bechol Yom Tamid Ma'aseh V'Reshit, continually to rework creation every single day. It's a kind of personal and professional challenge. How do we manage to keep ourselves fresh, to remain engaged with our work and our relationships over time? How do any of us remain focused so that the task at hand, even our own human connections to others, don't become routine, boring, deadening? What the Mishnah refers to as keva, fixed and ordinary. I think the answer is that we must be aware that each moment is truly different, that we ourselves are constantly changing and evolving, that our lives are part of the steadily progressing nature of this divinely created world. We may not be playing Tevye 2,000 times, but surely we are doing some things that many times in our own lives. What we can do is remember that each moment, like every audience, is unique, and each of us has the capacity to be truly holy. We welcome our Mivina, our expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking about love last week. By the way, Chag Sameach.
Thank you, and the same to you.
Happy holiday.
It's Purim. A happy month.
And I love Purim, and last week we were on the subject of love. So we began that exploration by talking about the fact that for those closest to us, we're commanded to do things like honor and respect. While those a little farther out were ordered to love, like the stranger. But love comes into play in some other interesting ways these days. Let's explore some of those.
Well, I'd be happy to. And this is really a very interesting and informative conversation about the evolution of Jewish thinking and tradition over time. When you look at the concept of love, sex, relationships in a Jewish framework. You know, the Garden of Eden is a pretty nice place, and that's the first scene we get where a man and a woman come together. And of course in Genesis chapter 2, we read that Adam and Eve, the two of them were naked, the man and his wife, and yet they felt no shame. And it was the first image we have in the Bible of actually, the instinct of a man and woman to be together and to feel no shame. But that is a very short-lived image, because almost immediately with the advent of the snake and the eating of the apple and the whole story of the fall, kind of, we're expelled from Eden, and almost immediately after the expulsion, sexuality becomes toxic in a lot of ways, with a lot of negative images, negative aspects throughout the Bible depicting, sexual, like subterfuge, Abram pretending that Sarai is his sister, not his wife, lying to protect himself, lots of sexual perversions. We see images of Sodom and other things, of course, sexuality by force, rape, incest. I mean, it's all through the Bible. It almost doesn't turn positive again until, I think, perhaps Ecclesiastes and, the beautiful, some beautiful images in Song of Songs.
Yeah, sure, Hashirim, of course.
And David and Jonathan, which is interesting because there's such a beautiful image of the love between two men, this sort of very close, deep, abiding friendship. But the topic that I think is on a lot of people's minds these days is the idea of where does Judaism fall with respect to homosexuality, and what does it have to teach us about that? And we know that there are two very concrete texts, both in Leviticus, that pretty much flat out say that a man, you know, shall not lie with another man as a man lies with a woman. It is an abhorrence, or a to'evah in Hebrew. And I'd like to really address that for a little bit. And we can certainly look at this again next week. But I want to put this in a context that both of these sentences, both of these texts in Leviticus come within an entire section where all sorts of cultic practices that tear at the very fabric
of
the tribe,
right?
Of the family, are within. So, for example, you know, these things come within: don't have sex with your mother, don't have sex with your sister, your stepmother, your aunt, don't have sex with animals. And quite frankly, almost all of them say, connect them to relationships. It is your mother's family, it is your father's sister. It is all about the tribe and the family and the relationship, and things that will break that apart are prohibited. At that time and in that place, the kind of sex that they're talking about between two men is the kind of sex that would be perhaps really one that would be a violence or denigration as opposed to loving relationships. They're not really dealing with that. So I'd like to go on next week, if we can, and kind of explore what that means today and where the various movements come in on this, weigh in on this.
We will do so. Thanks so much, Amy, and Chag Purim Sameach.
Chag Sameach gam lechem to all of you.
Thank you. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant on the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
I think the most special meal in all of Arizona is a dinner at Janos.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. I tell you, I'm really proud of it. We have so much fun. That's what Janos is all about. Special foods, special people, special occasions, but really using the best products available to us and really taking the time and crafting wonderful, wonderful, beautiful, and perfectly executed food.
My wife calls it, I think I've told you this before, magic food. It's just, you can't believe that it can taste quite the way it does.
No, that's nice of you to say. Well, I'll tell you, we really have a lot of fun doing it, and the flavors we use are really, really terrific. The service is great, and so we're just proud of what we do and love having people come in for dinner.
For an outstanding restaurant experience, the phone number for Janos.
615-6100. You can go online, www.janos.com.
For the best meal in all of Southern Arizona.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in Southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We began speaking about boundaries and distinctions in Judaism, beginning with Genesis, making the distinction between light and darkness, water and earth. And then we explored the boundaries around a cemetery that make a Jewish cemetery Jewish. Let's talk a little bit more about this very odd concept, the notion of an eruv, what it is and how it works and where you might find it.
Well, you probably know the halakha on this better than I do, but I know that, for example, at Camp Ramon, Wisconsin, where I worked for many years as a staff member, on Friday afternoon, we put an eruv around the camp, which was really a symbolic boundary, walling off the camp and making it into symbolically a walled city by nailing string to trees. And the string went all the way around the perimeter of the camp so that you could carry within that perimeter during Shabbat. That was the flimsiest of all possible boundaries, although from what I've seen of some of these Jewish sections of larger cemeteries around the world, there's no physical boundary at all. There's not even a piece of string. So I'm wondering if you can share with us some of your knowledge about what, Talmudically, what constitutes a boundary, what constitutes an eruv for the purpose of Shabbat, what constitutes a proper boundary for delineating a Jewish cemetery or the Jewish portion of a cemetery from the non-Jewish portion? I mean, what are the choices?
Right. It's a very it's an odd question, particularly for people who aren't Orthodox and grow up Orthodox or observantly conservative, whatever exactly that means, traditional. In fact, on Shabbat, you can only carry a certain distance. You can only walk a certain distance before you violate the rules against work. And so by establishing sometimes artificially large boundaries, it allows people to functionally go from one house to another and carry a pot of food or to carry their tallis and not have to wear it when they go to temple or whatever it is. Because sometimes there are actually, you know, there might be civic boundaries that are between someone and the synagogue. It's not very far. So an Eruv doesn't really have to be a firm wall or anything. It's really an indication to the Jew that he or she is crossing too far. And, you know, stay within this edge or you violate this law of the Sabbath. The boundaries around a cemetery are supposed to be a little more firm. And often in the old cemeteries, you'll see gates, you know, which will be called gates to eternal life or some euphemistic term, Shaarei Shamayim, the gate of heaven, you know, something like that. And those are theoretically supposed to be fixed walls with gates that separate the Jewish cemetery or the Jewish section from another area. But often that's, as you said, that's not true. It's not true here in Tucson. It's not true many places in which there may be a slightly raised area or people put a hedge or even just kind of a almost something no more indicative than an Eruv, maybe less so, as you said earlier. There's no real way to tell whether you're in the Jewish section or the non-Jewish section, except that you go from, you know, Jewish tars and Hebrew writing to something else.
Right. So I think that apart from the question of cemeteries, it's worth exploring maybe next week this whole question of distinctions, boundaries, borders, because in Jewish tradition, it's related to the concept of holiness. Separation and holiness are sort of two sides of the same coin. So if you're willing to talk about this a little bit more, I'd be happy to next week.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Good.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service, this week in the spirit of Rodeo Weekend, a Tucson tradition. One day a gorgeous woman gets on the bus, clearly distraught, and sits down next to a guy. She's visibly upset. Finally can contain herself no longer. She turns to the guy and says, "I just saw my therapist, and he says I have a big problem." "What's the problem?" the guy asks. And the beautiful woman says, "I can't tell you. I don't even know you." And the guy says, "Well, sometimes it's good to tell your problems to a perfect stranger on a bus." The girl says, "Okay, well, my therapist just told me I'm a nymphomaniac, and I only like Jewish cowboys. By the way, now that you know, my name is Susan." And the guy says, "Hello, Susan. My name is Bucky Goldstein." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And as Walker Ford says, how come some guys run into these people and I never meet them? In any case, we now welcome our Too Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill.
Good morning, Rabbi. This story I first heard from the Jewish storyteller Dante Gordon. Once there was a father who was becoming old, and he was at that place where he was looking back on his life and wondering what kind of impact he had had, especially on the lives of his three sons. And so curious, he called them to his house, because they now lived on their own with their own families. And he said to them, "Sons, I want to do something. I want you to clear out your former rooms in the house that I live in, that you grew up in. I want you to clear out each of your former rooms, and instead of all of your old things, I want you to fill it with some token of the significance that I have had in your life, because I just need to know." And so the sons, they acquiesced willingly enough, and they went, and over the next week, the father avoided that section of the house as his sons cleared out their rooms and began filling them with things. And the father made a point of not watching, not looking, not wanting to know at first. But at the end of the week, he gathered with his three children, and they took him from room to room, and the oldest son brought him to his room, and he opened the door, and inside of the room was just piles and piles of gold and silver and precious objects. And the father's eyes grew wide, and he looked to his son and he said, "What is the meaning of this?" And the oldest son said, "Ah, Father, even though we didn't have much growing up, you always made us feel rich. And that feeling of richness is something that I've carried with me to this very day, and it's something that I wish to honor." And the father had tears in his eyes, and he was happy. And he went to the next son, and the next son opened his door, and there were just piles and piles of books up to the very ceiling. And the father looked at him, and he said, "What is this about?" And his son said, "Father, you always gave us not only knowledge, but the thirst for knowledge, so that to this day I seek after knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. And so, Father, that is what I wish to honor." And again, the father had tears in his eyes, and he hugged his son, and he was happy. And then he went to his youngest son, and the youngest son opened the door, and inside, emptiness, a dark, cold, and empty room. And the father turned to his son angrily, and he said, "You were always a procrastinator. I knew that you wouldn't get this done in time." And the son said, "No, wait, Father, you don't understand." And he took from his pocket a candle and a match, and he went and he stuck that candle on the floor in the middle of the room, and he lit it. And suddenly, as that little flame flared up, there was light and warmth filling even the very corners of the room. And he said, "Father, you know, you always had a certain warmth about you, and you always set us on the path of light and of spirit. And it is a path that we continue to follow. And when one day the flame of your life goes out, just like with this candle, there continues to be a faint glow for a period of time. The faint glow, which will be a bright glow, that was your life, will live on in our lives." And the father, who is now crying, was happy with the honoring of all three of his sons.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now, a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Ki Tisah, the tale of the golden calf, the Maaseh HaEgel. While Moses is up on Mount Sinai carving the Ten Commandments in stone, or having God do it for him, the Israelites start to worry that he's not coming back. And so they persuade his brother Aaron to make them an idol of gold, a calf, that they can call their new god. And then they throw a big party. Joshua and Moses hear the noise from the camp below and come down the mountain. When Moses sees the cavorting and the idol being worshipped, he throws down the sacred stone tablets, shattering them. It's a shocking scene. It's one of the most dramatic and, for the rabbis of the Talmud, distressing portions in the whole Torah. The problem is acute. According to the text of the Torah, our people witnessed the divine power of the ten plagues, were personally saved at the shore of the Sea of Reeds by God, received direct revelation at Sinai, in short, experienced God more directly than any other group in human history ever has, and then almost immediately turned around and rejected God in order to worship a cow made out of their own jewelry. No wonder the rabbis of the Talmud and Midrash thought this awful story of the calf, this Maaseh HaEgel, was so destructive. How can a people given such a clear set of signs and wonders, including direct revelation and verbal command, only follow the true God for 40 days before pursuing an artificial and bovine substitute? Perhaps the answer lies not in our God, but in ourselves. We enjoy spectacle, are impressed by it, even awed by it, but as soon as it is gone, its effects linger a very short time. What makes us tick as human beings, what keeps us in line, is the very dailiness of regular rules and schedules, of the kinds of laws and rituals that are so much a part of practical Judaism. We need both ritual and structure, and until these are provided in a coherent way, we tend to flounder, even disastrously so, as we did at the time of the golden calf. Without a way to connect to God regularly, without prayer and a personal commitment to actually doing mitzvot daily, we quickly lose the ability to be holy. Instead, we chase gold or idols or both. The message is simply that we need more than grand ideas or sweeping spirituality. We need religion, a Jewish grounding in practice and experience, or we won't be able to remain ethical. Without that focus, we begin to worship golden calves of every kind. At the end of Ki Tisah, there is a kind of denouement for this painful story of spiritual failure and kind of a limited redemption. Moses goes back up Mount Sinai and brings down another set of tablets, and then he asks God to reveal God's very essence to him. Moses doesn't get all that he wants, but he is then privileged to experience God's passing presence. In other words, even the best of us, the person closest to God, must continually seek God's presence. How much more so is that true for the rest of us, we modern-day Israelites? If we continue to seek to find God, we too will be blessed with a touch of that divine presence. We too will find holiness. When we come back on Too Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world, talk with Josh Flagg of TV's Million Dollar Listing Show about what it's like to star in a reality show as a top real estate agent at the age of 23. All this when we come back on Too Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Fifteen more suspects were announced in the assassination of a Hamas official this last week. 10 of the new suspects have the names of Israelis with dual citizenship. Dubai last week released the names of 11 suspects with passports from Britain, Ireland, France, and Germany in the assassination last month of a top Hamas commander, Mahmoud al-Mabouh, in a hotel room in Dubai. 6 of those were Israelis with dual citizenship, and most of the passports were forged. Israel's Mossad has come under international suspicion in the killing. Al-Mabouh was the official responsible for arranging arms supplies from Iran to Gaza. He was a founder of the Hamas military wing, Izzeddin al-Qassam. He also was involved in the 1989 kidnappings and murders of two Israeli soldiers, Avi Sasportas and Ilan Sa'adon. The European Union has condemned the fraudulent use of passports by the Mossad. Several EU countries have called in their ambassadors to Israel looking for explanations. Israel, keeping with its policy, has neither confirmed nor denied its involvement. Rabbi Menachem Porush, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, a well-known Israeli Haredi rabbi and a longtime leader of one of the most influential ultra-Orthodox parties in Knesset, has died. He was 93 years old. Porush served for more than 30 years in Israel's Knesset, acting twice as deputy labor minister. He was known for leading the minority ultra-Orthodox Jewish community's efforts to slow secularization in Israel, leading epic battles for legislation enforcing strict Jewish laws that sparked charges from critics of religious coercion. The Jerusalem-born Porush also founded several yeshivot, religious education centers for the Orthodox. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu eulogized Porush, who died last week, as a dear, wise, and warm man, one of Israel's most dedicated public servants, and, of course, one who was totally opposed to the secular Jewish world. Thousands attended the funeral for Porush. He retired from politics in 1994. During his 3 decades in public life, he led many high-profile campaigns, including a drive to close the main road passing through Jerusalem's ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities like Mea Shearim on the Shabbat, and a mass demonstration against the Israeli Supreme Court in 1999 after that body issued rulings that allowed some shops to stay open on Saturday and non-Orthodox rabbis to preside over conversions to Judaism. My goodness. In other news, Israeli nuclear whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu has asked to be removed as a candidate for a, believe it or not, Nobel Peace Prize. This is the second straight year that Vanunu has asked that his nomination be removed. In a letter to the Oslo-based Norwegian Nobel Institute, Vanunu says he does not want a prize that has been awarded to Israeli President Shimon Peres because he considers Peres the father of Israel's nuclear weapons program and does not want to be associated with him. Actually, Peres, under the direction of Ben-Gurion, was the father of the Israeli nuclear weapons program. Vanunu served 18 years in an Israeli prison for discussing details of his work as a technician at the Dimona nuclear plant with a newspaper in London, the Sunday Times. He revealed Israeli nuclear secrets and gave photographs of the plant's operation to the British newspaper. For the second Olympics in a row, a Jewish male ice dancer took a silver medal at the Winter Olympics. This time in Vancouver, it was Charlie White, with partner Merrill Davis, who edged fellow Americans and 2006 silver medalists Ben Augusto and Tanit Belbin, who finished fourth in this Games. Augusto is also Jewish. "We had three great programs, so we were very happy," White said. Israel's brother and sister ice dancing team of Roman and Alexandra Zaretsky finished 10th, but they performed to music from Schindler's List in the free dance. That music was chosen in part as a tribute to 27 family members who died in Minsk in Belarus during the Holocaust. Who knew that ice dancing was a Jewish sport? And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Josh Flagg. Josh is from more or less my hometown, Southern California. He actually went to Beverly High. He is on the board of Friends of Greystone Mansion, which has kept Greystone Mansion, which is a remarkable architectural treasure in Beverly Hills, put it together, helped restore it. But that's really just a small piece of what he does. He's one of the top young realtors in the highly competitive and highly lucrative Southern California market, as I mentioned on Bravo TV's Million Dollar Listing, and the author of the book A Simple Girl, which is available, by the way, online at joshflagbook.com. Welcome back, Josh.
Hi.
All right, so your parents are very involved in the community. Did they give you a legacy of contributing back? Is philanthropy a piece
of my parents and my grandparents? My grandparents were on many different boards of charities, and over the years, donated lots and lots of money and time, most importantly, to charity, especially Jewish charities. And my grandfather retired very young, and that's what he dedicated the rest of his life to Jewry and helping other people.
Your grandmother, we mentioned earlier in the show, was in the Dutch underground. Where was she when the war ended?
When the war ended, she was in Holland.
Still in Amsterdam?
Yeah, she was in Amsterdam. She saw the tanks come into the main circle there in Amsterdam. The Canadians are the first ones that came. She saw the tanks circle and came in, and everyone was in the street. They were crying, and, it's an intense moment. That's also documented in the book.
I'm going to ask a little bit more about your real estate flair. You certainly seem to have a flair for this. You wrapped the whole house in a bow when you gave the keys to the new owners. Is that the most creative thing you've done?
I've done others. I've taken people in helicopters to show them properties. I've done that. I've done whatever it takes. The reward is, it could be very lucrative at the end. So it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter how much it costs, because at the end of the day, you can make a lot of money in this. So it doesn't really matter. The extent that you go, it doesn't matter how extravagant you are. That's what people like.
They like the extravagance?
Yeah.
Do you think this would play outside of Beverly, outside of the Southern California market?
Maybe in New York.
And pretty much that's it.
Yeah.
Your grandmother, going back to the book, A Simple Girl, there are many Holocaust survivors, and a lot of them don't like to tell their stories until much later. Some like to tell it a lot. Sounds like she didn't really want to talk about it for a while.
She tells you, the minute you meet my grandmother, within 5 minutes, you'll know her life story. She's very talkative. She'll tell you everything. She just never thought it was important enough to write a book about it. She doesn't think of herself as a hero or anything like that. She just, just casual talk to her.
Do you think about her as a hero?
Yes, definitely. She's definitely a hero.
How did she go from nothing to essentially a clothing empire?
Just working hard, determination, and just the need for, I guess, money, you know, but it turned out to be much more than she needed. Just, you know, it wasn't meant to be. It wasn't, she never wanted the, you know, what she attained. It was, that was, it just happened kind of. She just, you know, she always wanted to be comfortable at least, but you know, you're in the right place at the right time, I guess.
You're very young. If I can, you know, reveal a deep, dark secret, you're 24 years old. You've achieved a great deal already. What are your career goals?
My career goals, I mean, what I'm doing is I've already reached my goal. This is what I like. What I do right now is what I like. You know, I just want to, the rest of my life, I just want to be able to do what I do and travel and be happy.
And what's the weirdest thing that's happened to you in your real estate career so far?
Oh, I don't know. The weird things happen every day. There's nothing I can really pinpoint exactly.
Well, I heard something about a swimming pool.
Oh, that's, yeah. One time I was showing a house and I fell in the pool and I had to continue doing the showing. So I got up and just put a robe on and continued the showing and, you know, sold the house.
It worked.
Yeah, it worked. So I fell in the pool, but whatever.
The book is called A Simple Girl. It's about Edith Flagg and her journey from the Holocaust in under German control. You mentioned that her first husband died in the camps. Can you fill us in a little bit on the details?
Yeah, he died in Auschwitz. This is my father's father. He was on a train going over the Pyrenees Mountains, and the train got stopped, and there was a soldier who had his uniform in his luggage and stupidly kept his uniform in the luggage, and when they did a check on all the luggage in the train, they found this uniform. So they said the train was full of people that were trying to flee, you know, Holland. It was not just my grandfather. So when they checked it, they said, "Well, this is weird. There's a uniform in here. Let's just arrest everybody and put them first they put them in a in Westerbork, which is a detainment camp, a work camp. Then from there, when they found other world Jews, then they sent them to the concentration camp, which was Auschwitz.
So it was just chance. Why wasn't your grandmother with him at the time?
Because she said that she wasn't going to take a baby with her. She said it wasn't responsible enough to take a little child with her.
Across the Pyrenees into Spain.
It's just too dangerous.
Right, trying to get into neutral Spain. So
yeah, she tried to stop him, but he didn't. I mean, it's unfortunate, but, you know, what can you do?
Sure. And then, ironically, of course, she survived in Holland, in Nazi-occupied Holland. It's a really interesting book. The book is called A Simple Girl. It can be found at joshflagg.com. If you just go for Josh Flagg, you'll end up on a real estate site with very lovely homes, I might add.
You can also get the book off that site, too. It takes you there. joshflagg.com will also take you there.
Either way, whether you need real estate or a fascinating book about an extraordinary woman, Josh, thanks for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
Passover is coming up fast, so why is this night different from all other nights? Because you can spend it with Rabbi Sam Kohan, enjoying a Seder in a way that makes Passover live and breathe as never before for every age. And this year, it's part of the 100th anniversary of Temple Emmanuel, which makes this an even more extraordinary night. To truly experience this great festival of freedom, join Rabbi Sam Kohan for a second night Passover Seder that's simply the finest in Southern Arizona. This celebration is on Tuesday night, March 30th at 6 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel. Reservations are a must. Call 520-327-4501. The food is great and kosher, but it's the stories, songs, and spirit of Rabbi Kohan that'll make this a Seder you'll never forget. Learn, enjoy, laugh, cry, and eat well. Call 327-4501 to make your reservation now for Tuesday, March 30th, a memorable second night of Passover with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Or if you live on the northwest side of Tucson, there will also be a second night Seder in the northwest with Rabbi Ben Sharp. Call 327-4501 for more information on how to make this the best Passover ever through Temple Emmanuel. For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
If I had $1 million, if I had a... Oh, you're back, are you? I was just thinking about that $1 million listing and the 23-year-old and... Oh, well, anyway, happy Purim. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be the great Israeli singer-songwriter, guitar god, David Broza. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from a final Purim tune on this festival of joy and light. It's from my friend, Rabbi Joe Black, The True Story of Purim, and it's very silly. Have a Chag Purim Sameach, a happy day of Purim, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Each year on Purim, we have to endure him, that horrible chauvinist ruler, King Achashverosh, man with the mind of a sewer. Ay, 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 ay. Esther the queen is our heroine. She saved the day by paving the way for Haman to taste his own medicine. Ay, 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 ay. Esther the queen is our heroine. She saved the day by paving the way for Haman to taste his own medicine.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.